Rutner Rounds, podcast number 3. In today's episode, Stephen Schwartz interviews Dr. David Park as part of our Giants in Retina series. Dr. Park is a giant and leader in the field of academic and organized medicine, having served as the CEO and president of the Dean McGee Eye Institute and chair of the Department of Ophthalmology in the University of Oklahoma College of Medicine. More recently, Dr. Park served as the CEO of the American Academy of Ophthalmology for 12 years, and under his leadership, he helped to establish the Academy's Iris Registry, as well as a number of initiatives that strengthened our society and empowered our membership. In this episode, Dr. Park talks about his career path in ophthalmology, his guiding principles as a leader in organized medicine, and how he's helped to tackle some of the challenges faced by our profession. Let's check it out.
Hi, everybody. This is Stephen Schwartz. We're joined today by our special guest, one of our Giants in Retina series participants, David Parks. David most recently was the CEO of the American Academy of Ophthalmology and guided our specialty through choppy waters and a lot of innovation. And David is besides the pinnacle of organized medicine, has been in his career, an innovative and well-renowned retina surgeon. And so, David, thank you for joining us today on Retina Rounds.
Well, thanks, Steve. It's my pleasure. It's not too often I get to speak about retina, which is always near and dear to my heart.
Well, that's great. I'm so glad you're here. Let's start out with maybe you can tell us about how you landed in retina. I had the privilege of meeting Dr. Park Sr. And so tell us about where you're from and what your pathway was into medicine and then into retina.
Sure. As you mentioned, my dad was an ophthalmologist, and he was in a small group practice in Connecticut, general ophthalmologist. And when I was in medical school, I think all of us, or most of us, the vast majority of us, end up choosing a field in large measure because of a role model or a mentor that we had along the way. And so I had a really great couple of mentors as a medical student in ophthalmology, and two people named David Payton and Danny Jones. And they, although my father had kindled the interest, they really stoked it. And then when I started my residency in ophthalmology, I thought I was going to do oculoplastics. Why? Because that's, as a resident, usually the first bit of surgery you get to do is sewing up somebody's lid laceration or something like that. But it became pretty clear to me that what I really wanted to do was retina. And the reason for that, I think, it's probably the same reason that a whole generation of us went into retina. I mean, when you think about it, for me, you know, it was my third year of residency was 1980-1981. It was, it was a really exciting time in ophthalmology. I mean, we had phacoemulsification coming out. We had IOLs. We had, you know, some new drugs, and it was a fun time, but retina was really where it was. It was, you know, a young field, much, much smaller. I mean, the big departments at that time were 3 people or maybe 4 people. And vitreous surgery itself was in the very early stage of development. There weren't honestly very many vitreous surgeons out there who were comfortable with doing membrane work. There were some giants, absolutely, but not a whole lot of them. Certainly not in relation to the burden of disease out there, when you consider that all the things that we operate on now are still out there. And remember also that at that time, except at the research level, there was no air pump. There was no endo laser. There were no expansile gases. There was no approved silicon oil. Multifunction instruments were still in development. It was small was 20 gauge. It didn't get any smaller than that. And medical retina, of course, had no effective treatment for neovascular AMD other than photocoagulation in certain cases. And They were just beginning the generation of lots of multi-center randomized clinical trials, but a lot of them had yet to, really report their results. The MPS, the DRVS, the endophthalmitis vitrectomy study, those still hadn't come around yet. So, to me, there was just no more exciting place to be if you wanted to be on the cusp of a young subspecialty that was had a learning curve that was almost vertical. And so I think that's why a lot of us did it, Steve.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's still so exciting, and that's why a lot of people are still doing it. Tell me, when you were an undergraduate at Stanford, if I remember correctly, and how did you choose your medical school, and then how did you get recruited into residency?
I was at Stanford. Interestingly, it's sort of a one of those little factoids that absolutely no one knows. When I was a freshman at Stanford, they had the pre-med club. And so I kind of joined that just because it sounded like, something I could do that didn't require a lot of work. And so they, not knowing what to do with me, they sent me over to the Stanford Department of Ophthalmology. Just out of the blue, to be with a guy named Christian Sveng, and who those of you that are really into history will know was one of the fathers of the laser. And he didn't know what to do with me, so he had this new machine he was working on, a slit lamp mounted laser, and it was, if I remember correctly, a Ruby laser at that point, and he just let me punch holes in a piece of paper with it. And it didn't do anything for my career path, but now being something of a buff of history, I kind of realized, wow, I kind of stumbled into the lab of a person that was really doing some fantastic work. But at any rate, my reason, Steve, for choosing a medical school is not one I would recommend to anybody. My father had been a resident at Willmar, and I thought that Hopkins was where you wanted to go. And at that time, I had a girlfriend that was staying in the San Francisco region, so I had a draw there. But my first interview was at a place called Baylor College of Medicine in Houston that I quite frankly had never heard of. And I went down there, liked it, ended up having a bunch of others, and fortunately had some choices to make. And so I said to my father, "Will you stake me for another trip to go down and take a look at Baylor again? Because, it was so early, I don't think I really evaluated it properly." And he said, "Okay." So I called the dean of students down there and said, "You've accepted me. I don't really know if I want to go to the. I'm going to come down and look. Is there someone who could show me around?" And of course, those were the days before TSA. I get off the plane in Houston, and there was a medical student there wearing a white coat and holding my name on a sign and waving an American Express card. And he said, "You are you David Park?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "The dean gave me his American Express card and told me to show you a really good time this weekend." So we just, had a great time in Houston. I said, "If this is a pretty cool place, so I think I'll go there." And then, as you know, Steve, I met my future wife the first day of medical school. She was my anatomy lab partner, and so it turned out to be, for so many reasons, one of the best decisions of my life.
Isn't that great? Well, I don't think medical school recruitment works that way anymore.
I don't think so, but it was fun at the time.
Yeah, it was great. And then you stayed at Baylor for residency.
I did, and then I did a year of medical retina there, and and then went off to Milwaukee for a year of surgical, and it's boy, that was maybe one of the best, if not the best, decisions of my, educational path.
Right. So go back to what it was like to have Dan Jones in your universe, such a magnetic, charismatic luminary, and just share a little bit about what it was like to be around Danny. I got to know him later in his career, and just love him. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd love to, because Danny is one of my heroes. And he, most people of my generation remembered him because he examined them for their boards. And he could be a very tough and incisive, examiner. But he was also, he demanded the same high level of performance from himself, from his faculty, as he did from everybody else. And he was a lot of fun. And I look back on my career, and I'm sure I know you, Steve, have some people that were just absolutely so impactful in yours. I think of three or four, and Danny is on that list. He taught me how to think like a scientist. He taught me how to write a scientific paper. He taught me how to read the literature. And I don't mean the whole department. Danny was one of these people who would take you personally and say, and just grill you about how you approached a paper. And it taught you how to think and how to approach complex decision making. And he was just a fan. He was not only probably the best cornea person of his time, he used to teach neuro-ophthalmology and basic neurology to medical students. The breadth of his fund of knowledge was very extensive.
Spectacular. And he didn't really, as I recall, have a very high tolerance for perseveration or dragging your feet around an answer. When he examined me for the boards, he looked at me after about two answers and said, "You knew the answer 10 minutes ago and you dragged your feet through that answer. So I'm going to give you almost no time to answer these next few questions." So we did sort of a speed round, and luckily I was lucky enough to that he asked me questions that I knew, but we had a great time and became friendly after that. He was really a giant. And then Milwaukee. So how about the faculty of Milwaukee? What a great opportunity in those days.
Oh, I mean, it's one of these bits of history that will, it'll fade away as so much of history does, but it was just one of the best years of my professional career. Because, when you go back, and you know this, Steve, back in the early 80s, there weren't a lot of programs who were really teaching vitreoretinal surgery to fellows. You'd go there and you'd course some vitreous, and you might fool around the lab, but there were very few places then where they were actually letting fellows do stuff on the surface of the retina, make some mistakes, learn how to deal with them. And I remember in this 1 year of fellowship, I did over 300 cases as primary surgeon. And during that time, Tom Muhrenberg or Gary Abrams or Trex Topping or the other people who were there at that time didn't, sort of shove you aside. You did the case. They sat there sometimes for hours on long, complex diabetic traction or eggmatogenous detachments or giant tears or whatever, and just took you through it in a very constructive fashion. And it not only taught you how to be a vitreoretinal surgeon, not just the tactics and the techniques, but it also told you how to teach it effectively, which people like us who went into academic medicine, our own fellows have the Tom Aubergs of the world to thank for, because they were the ones that really were the role models that taught us how to teach.
A great
And
tradition.
Tom was, as some of our contemporaries know, worked with Robert Mockimer at Bascom back in the early days of the development of the visc. And if you look at the original books on the subject, they were co-authored by Robert and by Tom. And when I look back on what it must have been like, the stories I heard from them of doing the surgery when The failure rate was so high and the instruments were so crude, you still didn't know what it could do and what it couldn't do. It took tremendous perseverance and dedication on their part. And so we're all the beneficiaries of it. And the other thing about Tom, and I could go on forever, but I won't in the interest of time, about Tom, is that he had a humility, a humanity, a kindness, a real deep sense of ethics, and this personal, drive to learn, continually learn himself and to innovate that really moved our profession forward.
Sure did. And I would add to that bravery. You know, the real
Yeah.
heroes there. He was one of the real heroes, all those that generation, super heroic, but the patience as well, desperation, but heroism. And so it was easier for you to choose your fellowship because that was such an elite spot. But when you came out of fellowship, you had your choice, I'm sure, to go just about anywhere. And where did you go? And really, for our listeners, how did you evaluate your choice? You could have gone into private practice. You could have gone into academia. You could have gone into an academic practice. You could have gone to industry. How did you choose where you wanted to go? What were the metrics that you looked for as you were choosing your job?
Well, I'll tell you, but I'll also start with a disclaimer, which is I wouldn't recommend them to anybody else. I've learned.
Oh, and I'll disclaim back to you, you're not recommending, but let's synthesize this in a way that people who are making those decisions
Yeah.
can use it as a scaffolding for their decision-making matrix.
Well, the major thing for me was that my role models had been academicians and teachers. As you mentioned, the Danny Jones, the Tom Aubergs, people like that. And so you wanted to be like them. And so that for me, and also the realization, and I tell this to people now too, that if you're trying to decide between academia and private practice in the quote old days, those were the only two models, and academia and private practice were very different. And you could move from academia into private practice, but rarely go the other route. And because if you were trying to do, for instance, even just clinical research, there were some real giants who did it in private practice. I mean, in retina, probably Steve Charles is kind of the epitome of that for us. But most of it was done within academic departments. And if you wanted to do translational research, or you wanted to have an R01 grant, you had to be in academia. And I wasn't sure where I'd land, but I wanted to keep my options open. And so I was very fortunate to have some academic opportunities. And I decided to go back to Baylor, in part because in my case, it was also the best academic job for my wife, who is a pediatric neurologist. And so Danny Jones said, "Why don't you come back? You'll be the first full-time vitreoretinal surgeon on the faculty." Dr. McPherson, Alice McPherson, was in town, but she was not full-time faculty. He said, "I'll also make you the program director, residency program director, and I know you have an interest in academic medicine, and I'll help teach you how to run a department." That was a pretty heady thing to be offered, and that was why I chose to go there. Now, the funny story that is that at that time I also was approached by an academic big acad I'm excuse me a big private practice, and they came and they said, and this is 1982, late 82, they said, we'll start you at this multi six figure salary. And I go, wow. I mean, the most I'd ever made was about $12,000. And so I'd never discussed money with Danny Jones. And I said, well, Danny, I'd like to know how much you're going to pay me. And he quoted a number that was about a fifth of what they were offering. And I said, okay. And I went, and I've never regretted that either, because it, one thing I always used to tell residents and fellows, and it's as when I was a department chair, I used to offer to help them review their contracts as either academic or private practice. And the one thing I always tried to teach them, and I still think this is true, Steve, is that, if the culture works, the cash will follow. The reverse is not always true. And in other words, if it's a place that you're going to be happy, you're going to be comfortable, is going to meet your personal career goals, your personal philosophy, these are people you want to work with, you like their ethics, everything else will follow. But on the other hand, if you get your first job out of fellowship, you get totally driven by the money, your success is can certainly be there, but you may find yourself working in a system you don't like as much. And so and particularly these days, when you and I finish residency, although you're quite a bit younger than I am, typically physicians had one job in their career. The actual number was something like 1.3 across the country. I mean, you generally started and you stayed there. And now that number is almost four. People
Wow.
switch positions frequently. And so the point is that you shouldn't over sweat the financial details of your first contract. Do something because you think you're going to love doing it and be happy, and then see how it works. But you probably won't regret it from the standpoint of being forced into a position that you really regret for cultural or ethical reasons.
So what you're saying is they didn't give you that dean's credit card when you came back on the faculty.
Yeah, they never gave me that again.
Yeah. Well, that's a great and interesting set of parameters to think about. And I think it's a very, very wise personally. Changing culture is really tough, and getting yourself into the wrong culture is really tough. And frankly, knowing what you want can be tough. So people are lucky to have mentors like you that can guide them to do some self-reflection. When you left Baylor, was it to become head of Dean McGee at that time, or did you go somewhere else first?
No, Steve, I stayed at Baylor on the full-time faculty for 9 years and was a wonderful time. And for that time, I was the only vitreoretinal surgeon in a large academic faculty. And so I was on call 365, 24/7 for 9 years. And I had decided at that point that I wanted at some point to run my own department. Started looking around, and 9 years after going to Baylor, my wife and I and our family moved to Oklahoma City to the Dean McGee Eye Institute.
And how long were you there?
I was there, let's see, gotta do the math, 17 years.
And what a huge transformation that was. I remember from the time you got there, within 5 to 7 years, there was a meteoric rise in not just the quality, but the notoriety and the productivity of that department. Can you talk a little bit about how you built that culture?
I chose it, Steve, in part because it had all the framework for success. I mean, I could have gone to other places and been unsuccessful. The raw material was there. When I say the raw material was there, in part it was because the department was set up as its own nonprofit corporation. It had its own endowment out of the control of the medical school. And when I brought on faculty, I could bring them on to the full-time faculty of the university or bring them on as clinical faculty, but employees of the institute. So when I would find people I wanted to bring into the institution, I would always have this discussion with them about they had one track or the other. And we decide which track they felt most comfortable with. And I tell them they could, to a limited degree, go back and forth if they needed to, but we'd start them down one or the other. And we owned the building, we owned the land. sat on. And so when it came time to do things like build new buildings or buy a practice in the community or buy an ASC or I could do all that without ever asking the dean's permission. And that I can see you're smiling a little. That gives you a tremendous, as a chair. And we had a wonderful board of trustees at the Institute that were basically CEOs of financial companies and energy companies and major leaders in the community who basically gave me wonderful advice and along the way encouraged me to develop business skills, both formally and informally. And so it allowed us to take what was a small to moderate sized department and grow it to be a very large department and crack the top five in NIH rankings and things like this. And because you had that degree of independence. The other thing was, I just was, it's actually a wonderful community, very supportive of the medical institutions from a philanthropic and all sorts of other standpoints. And I had some really just fantastic people on faculty.
Yeah, it was it remains. What a legacy and what a great build. Key points: you weren't middle management because you had control. You were encouraged to grow, and you were well respected both within and without of the university. And it was a community that you grew to cherish. I'm sure you remember we took a couple of business leadership courses together. I think AUPO at one of the big business schools out here, and those were really fruitful. What did you find most useful from your formal studies of business that ended up applying to your career development?
It's an interesting question, Steve, and I'm not sure I've ever been asked it before, but I'll give you at least my perspective on it. I think it's the micro and the macro. And it's a little bit later in my career, particularly at the academy, when I would meet with people that were taking over departments and they'd say, what are the keys to being a good department chair? One of them was, did you have to be able to operate at 20,000 feet at the strategic planning, at the organizational leadership level, but you also have to be comfortable and know the value of diving down into the weeds periodically for a whole host of reasons. A, to let people know you've got your eye on things. B, to find problems and occasionally to suggest solutions. And also, it's part of the setting an example for less senior people in leadership. So, with that in mind, some of the big things: learning how to do strategic planning, critical. I mean, people, I think, misuse the term strategic planning all the time. They go, "Well, my strategic planning is that I'm going to go out and buy this building or something," and you kind of, that's not strategic planning. That is an operational tactic. And so learning how to differentiate strategy from tactics, from operations, I think is critically important. And there's some other things. Negotiation. I remember from the same course that you and I taught, I went into a course in negotiations one time, and I thought the important thing in negotiating was to win. And I realized through the course, through the time on the course, that that's not the purpose. The purpose is to get to a sustainable solution that works for as many people as possible because it is likely to lead to an uninterrupted path to success. And so, it's there's a good friend of mine who's a very successful, Fortune 100 CEO said to me, when you put food on the table, everyone has to eat. And I think that's the key to negotiation. The other key is listening, actually really listening and trying to figure out what's behind what the person is saying. What do they really want? And then sometimes you can give them what they want with less cost to yourself than you thought you were going to. And so that's the big side. The other side is real nitty-gritty finance. How to read, a financial statement. Principles and decision making in investing. One of the things I did along the way that was very helpful to me was ended up on the boards of, very large foundations, 9 and 10 figures, and for years, and you learn a lot about managing money. And so it was the big picture stuff, Steve, and then the little stuff.
Right. The details are always important. It's interesting. One of the takeaways in negotiation that I learned from a friend of mine is to always be polite and happy because you never know it, but it's invariable that these people across the table are going to come back around in your life. And so to
Yes.
always be collegial and polite and not let it devolve into acrimony. Which seems obvious on the surface, but it's really a life lesson as the farther along down the road we get, it's amazing how many people revolve back into our worlds.
I think you're so right, Stephen. That has got to be one of the top couple of lessons about leadership in general, which is, I remember when my wife took over as a department chair. She came to me and she said, "I don't know if I can do this. I don't know finances like you do." And I said, "It's not about finances. Being an organizational leader is 95% people. And you never know who your next boss is going to be. And it does, it doesn't cost you to be kind and civil and nice."
Yeah, that's exactly right. And speaking of your wife, can you share your the middle generation of fantastic triple generation of doctors? And Will is such a fine vitreoretinal surgeon, and more importantly, such a fine person. A lot of our listeners have young families and dream about their kids going on to become physicians. And I know, having watched Will grow up, that you never forced him and Julie never forced him to go into medicine. But what was it, besides the genetics, which were obviously stellar, what was it that you and Julie felt was important to impart in Will that helped him decide to go down this path? You must be so proud of him. I'm proud of him, and he's not even my kid.
Well, he is kind of, you guys have fished together and you've been at meetings together, and so you're as much a role model as many people, Steve,
Well, thanks.
and more than most. But I appreciate you saying that. I am proud of him. I'm proud of him for what he does in vitreoretinal surgery and what he does as a father and a husband. But I honestly didn't know he was going to go to medical school until he had already taken the MCATs. I didn't know he was really considering ophthalmology till after, he was kind of far down the decision path. And later on, years later, I asked him, and it gets back to the old role modeling and mentoring things that he lived with. Two parents who were physicians, both of whom loved what they did. We didn't come home. We weren't grousing about, the EHR or how much we were paid. We just, like so many of us, loved what we did. And we didn't do that so that he choose to go into medicine. But as we all know who have children, your children are always listening to you. They're always observing. That, and they're taking stuff in that you don't sense. And I found out years later that he really understood and internalized our love for what we do as physicians, the trust that patients put in our hands, the intellectual stimulation, the ability to be around interesting people. All those things are I think what really led him down that path as much as anything else.
That's fantastic. So let's shift gears. I remember when you were contemplating your next step from being chair at Dean McGee, and there were some really prominent academic even though Dean McGee was very prominent, even super prominent, chairs open. And then you decided to go to the Academy. Can you talk about that decision? Because it's been such a major contribution, not just for American ophthalmology, but for global ophthalmology and retina in particular. How did you decide to do that?
That's very kind of you to say, Steve. First of all, again, I'm
100% true.
surrounded.
That's not an editorial. That's
No,
verifiable evidence-based fact.
it's. I think it's part of it was very simply that I think that department chairs, quite frankly, or organizational leadership in general, needs to turn over, and I sensed that I was seeing the same problems in my department that I'd seen 5 years before and 5 years before that, and you need someone else to have a shot at making a better decision. And you also just need to let other people have a chance to shine. And so this was an opportunity for me, for that department to get the exciting new leadership. And also for me, I sort of believe that careers go through phases. Even if you stay at the same academic place or the same private practice, you go through phases where you may be more of a teacher, you may be more of a clinical researcher, you may be more of a surgeon and less of a medical retina person, or vice versa. You may become more active in your community. And I was ready for a phase change. And I had discovered that I really enjoyed leading organizations. I was fantastically fortunate to have great colleagues at the Academy, not just in retina, but certainly in retina, but throughout the ophthalmology and the staff of the Academy. And here was an opportunity to do something I hadn't done before and to have an impact beyond, a community in the center of the country that if you did a good job, could really impact the lives of tens of thousands of your colleagues and their patients. And so when the Academy came to me and said, "Would you be a candidate?" I said, "Yes." And when I went through the process and then they offered me the job, I said, I feel that I'm ready for it. I've run an organization, I've run a department, I've taught residents. And I'm not the best of the world at any of those things, but I think I can, do a creditable job. So I took it, and it was the perfect thing at the perfect time for me.
And for us. So I'm going to ask you a weird question. Think about the three, say, I'm just choosing three out of a hat, three lessons that were sort of high level, but also detailed lessons that you would always impart to your surgical fellows or junior faculty about surgery. And then how did you impart what takeaways from those? What were they, and how did they apply to you as you moved into the academy and leadership? So, what were the three things you taught residents? If you think back, maybe not the particulars of how to approach a diabetic, but preparation, kindness, what were the big lessons for you to impart to young surgeons? Let's start there.
Well, I think the first thing, Steve, is that we're talking about negotiating earlier, that to a certain extent, the decision to have surgery, for example, for a patient is a little bit of a negotiation. I mean, they want something. You may say, obvious, they want to see better. Well, yes, but they also have a function in mind. And so you want to understand what that is. I mean, the patient that's had a macula detachment for 3 months who wants to read, the paper or his iPad in the morning, you've got to give them reasonable expectations. And so it does take a conversation. And in so much of medicine, unfortunately, I don't think this is true in retina or in ophthalmology so much, but unfortunately, as I've gotten older and have more things done to my body, I find myself interacting less and less with the surgeon and more with other members of the team who may be very comfortable, but still, someone has to sit down and have the discussion with the patient as to what the process is going to be like, what the outcomes are going to be like. And because at the end of the day, everybody is going to be is going to benefit from a real basis of trust. And that trust is going to be is person to person. It's not, you went to school at Department X. It's going to be, you look the person in the eye and you tell them what the process is going to be like, what kind of outcome they can expect, what the risks are, and then they enter this, in my experience, generally listen more closely to what you have to say. When you say to the patient, I'm going to want you to be face down for X number of days post-op, and this is what that means, they're listening to you. So I think the first thing is to develop that relationship. And then the always the last thing, what I would tell residents and fellows was to ask the patient, is there anything that I haven't told you, any question you haven't asked that you want to ask now? And leave it open-ended. And occasionally something will come out of that that you never expected. And it was and it makes all the difference in the world. I can think of in my career, and probably you can too, more than a couple of times that when you ask that, patient all of a sudden falls apart, and you find out this hidden fear that they were afraid to ask before because it wasn't part of the normal informed consent process, and you need to get that on the table and taken care of. So that's number one. And number two was that to go into the surgery with a plan, realizing, as the old aphorism goes, that very few battle plans survive the first encounter with the enemy. We all know you're in the eye and you think you're going to do X and you do something different, but at least you start and you visualized it in your mind what you're going to be doing. It's not totally automatic, and I think it just makes you a more attentive person in the operating room. And I think it also makes you a calmer person because you've got a plan, you've done this before, you're going to execute it, and which is important because weird things happen in the operating room. And starting with that basis, I think is very, very important. The other thing is to pay attention to the critical details that that may be somebody else's responsibility. And the classic one in retina is gas dilution. I mean, Steve, for nearly 2 decades, I was on the claims committee at OMIC. I can't tell you how many cases came to OMIC that were gas dilution errors, not made by the surgeon so much, but made by the person that was doing it. And it wasn't checked, observed, whatever, by the surgeon. And it led to loss of all vision. Again, gas dilution is something that is going the way of the dodo, but there are always be things like it, a drug you're injecting or whatever. I remember going back to Tom Auberg, one of the gentlest human beings on the planet, whom I never heard criticize, openly, a fellow, a resident, a nurse, a technician, but who absolutely took apart an anesthesiologist one time for not watching the electrolytes of a young, brittle diabetic immediately post-op. And
Details.
Details.
So just that's communication, kindness, have a plan, and be detail oriented. So let's jump ahead now. You get to the academy, and ophthalmology and medicine in general is facing a huge challenge, crisis level challenge, reimbursement, coverage, access, certification, benchmarking, industry inroads, scope of practice, you name it. I mean, I'm sure there are a couple more that I left out, but all of those give me indigestion just thinking about
Right.
them. And so you took those principles of communication, kindness, having a plan, and being strategic, not just tactical, and being detail oriented, and you came up with a solution that had the potential to solve against all of those problems. And essentially, for the audience, what that was David came up with a way to take our anecdotally strong position and credentialize it with actual real world evidence. So, David, maybe you can explain to our listeners how you came up with the idea for the IRIS database.
Well, thank you, Steve. I would say, first of all, it wasn't just my idea. People like Bill Rich and Flora Lum and many others were absolutely indispensable to this moving forward. And the people who were the very early adopters and really recognized its potential. But the IRIS Registry, I think many ophthalmologists, although they know what it is and they see what it's accomplished, don't recognize how unique it is in medicine. There are a lot of societies with registries. There is not a single one that has anywhere near the percentage of its professional community that uses it. Not another one that has had the impact on the science base that IRIS has. And also, not someone who's developed or not especially developed a plan for sustainability. You were a key part of that, Steve, in your time at Digicide and bringing this together. But I think what you're really getting to is the understanding that in our world right now of artificial intelligence, large databases, large language models, that when you and I and others of our age group were in practice in the early parts of our career, and we'd have a patient in front of us, and with a retinal detachment, a maculon retinal detachment, and we tell them, what was going to happen, and what, and they'd, and we'd say in the literature says, that you've got an X percent chance of the retina reattaching and staying reattached. Every so once in a while, we'd have a patient and say, "Well, doctor, how do your patients do?" And most of us didn't have the data. We didn't know how we did.
So
And
you're the guy we can blame for taking away the privilege of making that up.
well, no, we'll use the EHRs are in there to a certain extent, but and also at the same time, we didn't a lot of times know the impact of factors of comorbidity, or other demographic factors. We knew, let's say, how maculon detachments would do. Did we know how people of a certain ethnicity, age group, who were also diabetic and had glaucoma did? No, we didn't, because we needed a big database for that, but that we didn't have. And so what IRIS allowed us to do, and it was the right thing at the right time, because more and more ophthalmologists were transitioning to EHRs.
Electronic
And
health records.
yes, to electronic health records, and software had gotten to the point, engineering had gotten to the point where you could actually take data from multiple platforms and integrate it. And so we were able to actually take that and begin to use that for what is our shared holy grail to improve the quality of care. And at the same time, something that could be used to qualify for for quality-based payment under Medicare and in certain commercial plans. It's something that you could use to advance the science of ophthalmology. There have been discoveries that have come out of there that we've never known before. And it's because we didn't have the database that we could query in a sufficiently sophisticated fashion to actually ask the questions that needed asking. So it's something that I think has been transformative for the profession.
It has been transformative. When you think about, for those of you who are listening domestically, reimbursement, solving big questions like certain IOL issues or non-infectious uveitis with anti-VEGF injections, things would happen like it would bubble up with one particular product, and then there would be this big word of mouth spread that it was all related to that product. And then we'd look in the IRIS database or in the Verana database, and we would see that no, it was equivalent across all, or it was segregating to one batch, whatever it turned out to be. These questions that really change the way we think about and approach both regulatory issues with government, with CMS. The FDA loves the IRIS database. Wiley and Malvina and the people at the FDA loved it, and their predecessors will love it and do, and industry loves it. But most importantly, it's great for the patients. It's also great for providers because it allows us to benchmark. Outcomes are something that we talk about all the time in a very unprofessional and unscientific way. And now with the if you're participating in the IRIS database, putting your data in, you can benchmark really easily across your practice. If you've got, remember the anecdote about what are we going to do about Bob? The one partner who maybe isn't getting the same results as everybody else. How are we going to approach this partner and talk to them about improving their skills? So what I love about IRIS, besides the science and improving quality care, you came up with a strategic solution that solved for multiple issues at the same time. And a result, you poured resources into it. And we got lucky. We helped sustain it with some evolutionary steps in bringing it into Verana. But it's available to everybody, and its resources are just endless. And you're absolutely right to credit Bill and, of course, Flora, who is the queen of the domain of the IRIS database. And you're absolutely right, it wouldn't be anywhere near there. That I'll share the anecdote that you suggested to me, which was just after the COVID pandemic. Together, you and I looked at how patients did and how our specialty did providing care to patients who had acute AMD and neovascular AMD, and whether we got the injections to them. And we were able to segregate it down to the states that had lockdowns and the states that didn't have lockdowns and where the docs going. And we showed that our specialty performed at a stellar level, and we protected our patients despite risk to ourselves or uncertainty around it and all that mass hysteria that may or may not have been appropriate at the time. And it's just been a magnificent step forward. And I was going to ask you, and I know you'll be humble about this, but the effect that the IRIS database has had on other subspecialties, right? Talk about that for a second. I know that other subspecialties have tried to take lessons from IRIS, and just how has it helped even outside of ophthalmology?
Well, so you're talking about other specialties.
Right.
I think that one of the things it has given us, Steve, and you're absolutely right, the FDA, NIH, CDC, these organizations really respect what we as a profession have done, all of us. Every ophthalmologist who submits data to IRIS is part of IRIS, and they share in the success of Iris, and should be proud of doing this. I mean, it's a the when I was talking with someone at the School of Public Health at Hopkins a couple of years ago, and they were saying, ophthalmology is leading the way in showing how a profession can work together and become truly data-based in a way that others had difficulty doing. And the other thing is, we as a profession have always led in randomized prospective clinical trials. When you go back to the early days of dealing with ROP and diabetic retinopathy, some of the very first ones in all of medicine were in ophthalmology. Well, now what we're doing is leading in advancing the science of population health based not on prospective randomized trials that are incredibly expensive and take years and years to get, but going back and querying a massive pile of data that has been curated such that it's valid. And I'll give a classic example to me, Steve, is at one point, one of the commercial anti-VEGF drugs was being used, as we all know, for other indications, other with neovascularization outside of AMD.
Myopia.
Myopia being the one I'm thinking about. And so what happened was, but it wasn't FDA approved for that. And so payment wasn't there for that. And so the question was, oh my gosh, do we need another 5 years worth of prospective randomized trials in this population, which is going to be difficult to recruit for, et cetera. And so the company said, what do we have in the IRIS registry? We went back, we had a lot of it, and gave that data to the FDA, and they said that works for us, and it was approved. And all of us, you and I, knew as clinicians it worked, but we didn't have the data. Now we had the data, and we had it fast, and it was absolutely incontrovertible.
Right. So my takeaway from that is retina leading the way forward for all of medicine, and not just in clinical trials, now in data and soon in AI or already in AI. And thanks in large part to you. And for our listeners who are domestic, you'll understand that the move that David made from Oklahoma City to the San Francisco Bay Area was probably the longest jaunt on the American political spectrum that you can go from. I think it was Tom Coburn to Nancy Pelosi, if I remember correctly. And he survived it and maintained his values. And what I love about the IRIS database is that we, as physicians, as retina specialists, and contributors to the IRIS database, are doing what government should be doing. And we're doing it for ourselves, and we are improving not only the lives of our patients and our families and our practices and our universities, but we're also, thanks in large part to our guest today, David Park, the beacon, the shining light for the rest of organized medicine. And I think, David, I'll ask you for one last comment, which is in this incredible career, and thank you so much for sharing it with us today, just a snippet of it. I would say, looking at it from the outside, probably one of the greatest joys has been giving back. And if you could just say a word about that to our young listeners who are contemplating how they're going to comport themselves, whether they're in Asia or South America or Europe or the Middle East, wherever they are, this universal theme of not doing things for yourself, but for doing it for the community, and what that's meant to you.
Well, I think I'm so glad you ended on that note, because that's really the one of the hallmarks of being a professional, is that you have a sense of responsibility to your community, however you define it, whether it's a local community, a hospital community, a national community, international community. And I think that all of us find the things that we say when we're in our dotage, these are the parts of my legacy that I'm, most proud of. For many of us, for most of us, hopefully, it's our families. That's a very important part of things. But it's also, we all have the opportunity as part of that legacy to have an impact on people, whether it's individual people, patients. We all talk about the physician-patient relationship. I think it is an absolutely sacred relationship. And if your career is as a solo private practitioner, being, taking care of individual patients, the best you can, always putting their interests first, that is fantastic. That is as good as someone that splits the atom in their backyard. But if you want to say, okay, there are other things I can do, whether it's being involved, not just in a medical community, but in your community, whether it's schools or whether it's nonprofits or whatever it is, or whether it's building a company through your own personal innovation that is out there, maybe you'll make money on it, but at the other hand, it's to advance the life of folks on the planet. That's a very important part of the legacy. And the one thing I truly believe, Steve, is that everybody has that potential. You don't have to be working for a nonprofit in a developing nation. You can do that in your own home, and that's part, and looking for those opportunities, developing them, taking advantage of them for the right reasons is part of being a professional, and it's part of why physicians have historically been respected. We have to uphold that as we go forward.
That's inspirational, David, and exactly right. And so we've been talking with David Park, CEO Emeritus of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, and innovator, retina surgeon extraordinaire, academic, and most importantly, friend. David, thank you very much for this, and we'll look forward to seeing you soon.
Same here. Thanks, Steve. I had a great time.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.